Attention Hudsucker employees. Attention Hudsucker employees. We regretfully announce that at 30 seconds after the hour of noon, Hudsucker time, Waring Hudsucker, founder, president, and chairman of the board of Hudsucker Industries, merged with the infinite. To mark this occasion of corporate loss, we ask that all employees observe a moment of silent contemplation.
Hello and welcome. Welcome and hello. This is Wait, You Haven't Seen. It's a show where we talk about movies and specifically talk about a movie at least one of us has never seen before. I'm your host, Travis, aka TV's Travis. This is episode number 265. And the movie this week is 1994's The Hudsucker Proxy. Joining me to talk about it, he had seen it, I had not, it's Ryan Estrada. Ryan, how are you?
I'm so excited to bully someone into watching The Hudsucker Proxy. Everyone I talk to is like, that's the worst Coen Brothers movie. And I'm like, no, it's the best movie.
I will have some questions for the people that say this is the worst Coen Brothers movie. But before we dive into that, what I want to know first is, what's your history with this one?
Well, I mean, this movie came out in 1994. I was 13. I think I saw The Shawshank Redemption and first this. And then I'm just like, this is cinema. Like, if it's 1994 and Roger Deakins shoots a movie where with a two-word nonsense title where the adjective is the name of a sad building where Tim Robbins works in the basement but gets a new job and a fancy desk in the 1950s because an old man killed himself and he proves himself to be good at business but a gray-haired sociopath doctors evidence to put him in solitary confinement to cover up a mistaken identity scandal, but Tim Robbins changed clothes in the boss's office and legal paperwork to gain access to all information's business's money are hidden in the new clothes, and it's all narrated by a gravelly voiced old black man with a one-word name out of Exodus who loves talking about the passage of time and first impressions, and there's endless footage of rubber stamps on forms and the pipes inside the walls. It's going to be the best movie ever made. And unfortunately, I mean, even though Shawshank Redemption is great, everyone's seen it, this is the other one that fits all of those things that more people need to see.
I did not really make that connection while I was watching it today in preparation for this, but holy crap. It is so there are so many similarities between those two. It's kind of ridiculous. That's amazing. So this is a movie that has been on my radar personally for quite a while. I love the Coen brothers, but I've got some holes and gaps in my Coen brothers watching because I just didn't see certain movies. And then I get busy. I'm working on other things and I just can't find the time to do it. So part of what's great about this show is somebody will come along and bully me into watching a movie that I haven't seen. And this is one of those. And I'm just going to say right off the bat, thank you. This was amazing. I enjoyed the hell out of this movie. I can't believe people would say, I mean, this within 20 minutes of starting this movie, I was like, well, this isn't my top five Coen Brothers films of their movies that I've seen. And I did a few weeks back. I had my friend Josh on and we talked about Blood Simple. I hadn't seen that one. It was their first movie. And we both kind of agreed, like, it's really good, but it's sort of that second half of their top 10. Like, it's going to slot a little bit lower. And at that time, I had some ideas. I put this right up there for me with favorites of Big Lebowski, No Country for Old Men, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and Raising Arizona. And I put this right up there. I love it in that way. It reminded me of that Raising Arizona era of the Coen, sort of just it's silly, it's goofy. It looks phenomenal, like up and down. I can't get over how good this looks. You mentioned Roger Deakins, and then Dennis Gassner and his production design was off the charts good. My biggest takeaway when the movie finished was, I am mad at myself for not having seen this until today. I can't believe I went this long, and I've heard about it. I've heard that, and I never heard anybody say that it was the worst Coen Brothers, but I had a friend of mine that really liked it. It just was one of those that kind of slipped me by, and thank you for bringing this one to my attention because this movie is a trip. It's so much fun.
Yeah, I think it's just whatever. You know, the Coen brothers have their two lanes that they go in. They go very serious and very goofy. And whichever one you see first, you're going to be a little bit turned off by the other, you know, not necessarily all the way, but like, you know, a lot of people, when if they watch like No Country for Old Men or Fargo first and they see this, they're like, what is this goofy crap with all the weird voices and people pulling weird expressions? Whereas I was the opposite. I watched this like three times a week as a teenager. And then I watch No Country for Old Men. I'm like, where are the jokes, man? What is this?
Yeah, I can see it's a stark difference. Like they basically, they do goofy stuff like this, or they adapt Cormac McCarthy in something that just makes you like, ah, man, I don't know if I want to go on anymore, you know, because they're just so bleak. But that's one of the things I think that makes the two of them such good filmmakers is you look at Blood Simple. Blood Simple is very much in the vein of Fargo and No Country for Old Men. It's a very serious, very noir-styled movie. And it's very bleak. But then they followed that up with Raising Arizona a couple of years later, which is just total different end of the spectrum. And I love that they have that kind of a balance, that they're able to do both of those things while making everything interesting to look at the same time. I sort of feel like this kind of movie, this one, Raising Arizona, to an extent, Big Lebowski, feels like they influence somebody like Wes Anderson a lot, in sort of Wes Anderson takes it to a different extreme almost, but kind of that idea where he's got a very quirky view of things. This movie has such a unique view of New York in, was it 1958?
Yeah,
I think is when it's set, but it's kind of more like the 30s almost, 30s and 40s. But I love that. I love the stylized nature of it and like the hyper reality fantasy elements in play. I thought were super fun too. And you mentioned voices, like the voice. I love Jennifer Jason Leigh from the moment she comes on screen. I'm like, wow, she's just going for it with that, the accent and the cadence that she's talking in. It was so good. I really enjoyed that.
If you look at like even some people in the backgrounds, like if you look at people that aren't on the focus, like extras, like the one I noticed, like when Hudsucker falls to his death and the woman screams, if you look at the guy next to her, the face he's making, like you're looking at the woman, but this guy just like has his mouth wide as open as he can in a grimace and just rotates his head like he's like, and you know, podcast listeners can't see it, but he does the weirdest expression, but it works in this like heightened reality that they've made.
Yeah, there's something to creating those heightened realities in this type of a world that just, it draws you in and it engages you. Because the story of this, pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Basically, Tim Robbins is fresh in the workforce out of college. Warner Hudsucker,
Waring
Hudsucker jumps to his death. We don't get a reason why at first, out of the building, and the board basically want to tank the company so they can buy the controlling interest because they figure out that's what they need to do. They're greedy, and so they bring him as a patsy, effectively. But then he does well. It's like a fairly basic story, but the world they create is so interesting. And the characters, all of the characters, from the people on the street to the boardroom and the board members cracked me up every time they would be on screen. Mm-hmm. This movie reminded me of another movie. And tell me if you got this at all. Have you ever seen Terry Gilliam's Brazil?
Yeah.
Okay. I got a lot of Brazil feelings from this. Not exactly because Gilliam is such a unique filmmaker in his own right, but I think one of my notes actually was, if Brazil didn't somewhat influence this movie, I'll eat my hat, because there had to have been some crossover there. Like the Coens had to have seen that and at least taken something from it, because it's got that same feel to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's what's fascinating about this movie is that they take the kind of production design that you would expect in like a big science fiction movie, but they put it toward like a guy gets a job.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
Like you said, the story is very basic. It's just a business story, but the way that, like, this is very much, to use the parlance of another movie podcast, this was their blank check. Like they done well in these small projects, you know, big projects, but with smaller budgets. And finally, they're like, look, give us so much money to make. Like, this is like, imagine now a film era where like they built the entire city in miniature, but like each building was like taller than a person that the camera's going through. All the money they spent on that. And then like for decades after, like, two Batman movies, The Shadow, Independence Day, all these movies were using their leftovers. Imagine like a Batman movie being like, oh, we don't have the budget to make new sets. Get that that Hudsucker proxy set.
Right.
Gotham City.
That's fantastic. Like, I love stuff like that because it's filmmaking. Filmmaking, in a sense, filmmaking is storytelling and it's problem solving. You have a story you want to tell. All right, how do you tell it? And then how do you get over the hurdles that are going to stop you from doing that? And one of them was they wanted this New York. And so they just built it and they built it at that scale. And it gives it that look. Like, I loved, there's a shot at the party where Norville, Tim Robbins, is out on the balcony. He's got the ice pack on his face. It's after he got punched by the Finnish guy. And you can tell it's on a soundstage and the backdrop is just a flat, you know, two-dimensional backdrop sitting behind him. But I love the look of it because it feels consistent with this world.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about who are these people that dislike this movie. Like, one of them was Roger Ebert, who has many great opinions of movies, but wasn't a fan. Like, the quote that I still remember, this quote from when I was 13, he said, "Isn't there something wrong when you walk out of a movie humming the sets? Not humming the music, but humming the set. Like, there's the sets are stuck in your head." And I'm like, absolutely not. That, like, again, if I could not watch this movie for years, and I remember every set because each one is telling the story. Like, whether it's showing like oppression, whether it's showing power, like even just the amount of money they must have spent to have that clock in the background of all the sets, because the two offices of the CEO's office and Musburger's office are like behind the clock. And like, you just see like the shadow of the minute hand and second hand passing. And like, even the way they decided to set them up, like when you're in Norville's office, since it's going clockwise, like you see like the numbers, you know, the thing going up, or like it goes around, it's like going up. Whereas when you're in Musburger's office, the hand's going down, and like whether you're being pushed down into like the depths of depravity or like wanting to rise up, it's just, you don't think about these things when you're watching it, but they, like, you can tell as you watch that every single rivet in every set was there for a reason. Like, how much of his hair was sticking up, they thought about, like, and just being able to make comedy out of the sets. Like, the one of the biggest laughs that I get is when she opens his desk and the pencil rolls out. Like, that's a laugh. No one's saying a line. It's just a pencil slowly rolls out because it shows it's like a metaphor for his mind and his job. Like, he has nothing. He doesn't know what he's doing. He just has a pencil in an empty drawer.
And I love that because you're right. It is on the subconscious level, it's the stuff that's the storytelling and world building that informs the rest of your movie. So you can have a very simple plot. You don't need a complex plot. It's very straightforward. Make your characters interesting and then put them in a world that will capture your interest. Because I did see the brief video of Siskel and Ebert when this movie came out, and they didn't spend much time on it. And Ebert didn't seem to love it all that much. Gene Siskel seemed to like it a little bit more. He had some more kind of nice things to say about it. But it's one of those where the movie is more than the sum of its parts. Like, everything to it plays into it. The costuming, the sets, the music. I adored the music. This is Carter Burwell. So he's worked with the Coens a number of times and did the music here, along with some other. There was some stuff from a ballet, I think, that they mixed in there, some kind of recognizable classical stuff that I thought was great. But this was, you know, they have Dennis Gassner, as I mentioned, who had worked with them from Miller's Crossing on. And those sets and those costumes and then casting. The Coens just always cast stuff so great. And it starts with your main guy, Tim Robbins. I love Tim Robbins. I don't know how big a fan of him you are or not, but he's one of those. I just love seeing him in stuff. He's great. And he can do comedy so well because he is just a goofball. And he does that great. But then he can also be serious. Like, he's kind of a great actor for the Coens to work with. I'm surprised he didn't work with them more. Just because of that versatility and what he can do. Because go ahead.
Yeah, in 1994, he's the greatest actor ever made. Like, he's in these, even though, like I said, these movies have so much similarity, his character in his both of his 1994 movies were the complete opposite acting style.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Which I love that. I love an actor that can do that and be versatile. And you can tell he likes doing both. Like, he brings it to a dramatic role like Shawshank, and then in here, he brings it still, and he's having fun in both instances, but in very different ways. I love that. And you're right. Even simple things like his hair, how goofy and curly his hair was to start it off in his costuming. And then they cut it all down and they put him in the nicer suits, but he gets more and more disheveled as things go awry for him. I loved all of that. And then, of course, Paul Newman. How good was Paul Newman in this? And the funny thing was, I read that he got approached like 10 years earlier about it. Like, the Coens wanted to do this before. And again, this is internet IMDb trivia, so take it with a grain of salt. But supposedly he got approached, and he didn't know if he wanted to do comedy. And so they just kind of waited around and then finally came back to him. But he's so good in this. He nails it. He plays that part perfectly.
Yeah, and the as controlled as he is in that character, like, you can tell he's doing comedy, and his lines are very funny, but he has a lot of control so that, like, Tim Robbins can bounce against him being like weird and goofy. But just that he's so scary in that, like, you never hear him really scream at someone or yell at that. You know, there's a few moments where he like shouts to his secretary, but just the most terrifying he is when he's just very calm and calculating.
Yeah. And I mean, it helps when you've got that Paul Newman voice too, right? Like, that's a commanding, gravelly, distinct voice that if he wouldn't have to get very loud to make me like, yes, sir. Sorry, sir. I'll get right on that, sir. Like, you know, it's just, that's Paul Newman. It's that presence. It is funny to think about how much shorter he is than Tim Robbins. And you see it at the party. Because, I mean, Hollywood, a lot of actors are not as tall as you would think. But Tim Robbins is. He's like 6'4" and all of that. And so seeing him walking around, you know, he's a head taller than half the people. So it did kind of crack me up seeing, because of what a physical presence Paul Newman can be. And then he just looks so short next to Tim Robbins. And yet, still, he would be intimidating. I think those Paul Newman eyes, too, those steely blue eyes, make a big difference. But he was great. And you can tell, again, he's having fun. He's having fun doing this because he gets to play comedy and be a little goofy, but do it in a sort of straight man and the straight man, funny man way.
Yeah.
So it's that good balancing act.
Yeah. Everyone kind of got the assignment in this, when it's a very, very distinct acting style that if one person was off, it would really mess up the whole thing. But luckily everyone seemed to have like come together and be like, we're going to do this very, 1930s style acting, but like a kind of a parody of that, but still have the emotion and heart that we need. Like, we don't want to make it seem like a goofy parody. We want it, you know, get the audiences used to it at the beginning, so that by the time we get into this emotional heart of it, that doesn't take us out of it.
Yeah. And that's where it reminded me also, I mean, not just the setting and sort of the tone, but that the acting choices reminded me of Brazil, because that movie had the same kinds of things going on where you have, it's very hyper reality. It's very like, it is over the top, you know, and I mentioned Jennifer Jason Leigh, and she's doing this like mid-Atlantic accent and just very, very quick and snappy. with all of her dialogue. But it doesn't feel out of place, even though not everyone is doing that same style of speaking. She is, but even the other people in the newspapers aren't. And it somehow still, it manages to not feel like this one person sticking out doing something very, very different. And you know, you got some Coen Brothers, staple actors, Charles Durning. I love him. And so I knew nothing about this movie going into it. Other than I looked at the cast list before, in looking, you know, just being a nerd on IMDb. So I see him as the number four, and then he's out of the movie minutes in, 10, 15 minutes into the movie, and he's jumped out the window. I was like, wow, they put him that high on the list and he's out that quickly. Then he pops up again at the end and probably one of my favorite moments. But there's something about him when he's having that realization moment, when Hudsucker is sitting there and you get that fantasy element, right? It's that not quite real world where the reveal of the coffee stain on the newspaper and then the wind blows it out the window and you've got the fate of that following Norval down the street. Meanwhile, in the boardroom, Hudsucker is having his realization moment of, well, all right, this is it. And I love the way those two played off of each other, feel wise. And just his performance in that moment was great, where he just slowly takes his pocket watch out and winds it up. And just because I love Charles Durning as Pappy O'Daniel in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And here he's doing a different character, but sort of that same kind of mode in some ways. Not exactly the same, but I got some similar feeling to it, especially when he got up on the table ready to run there. I don't know. I got that feel, but like I just loved him.
I mean, like, can you imagine any other movie that like I've never imagined that you could like have so much fun watching a depressed old man commit suicide? Like it's hard to even say, but like it's because at first you don't even know what he's doing. He just like everybody's quiet and he gets on the table and does his little like weird stretches. Like you have no idea what's going on. And then just he goes out the moment that that Norval goes in, and it sounds weird that like if anyone hasn't seen some movies, listen to this, they're gonna be like, why did you have a sociopath on your show? Why is he having fun watching an old depressed old man commit suicide? But it's so entertaining. And then when he comes back, like this is a movie that has not had any supernatural elements at all. You'd think that if like in the last few minutes of the film, suddenly there's an angel and a man floating in the sky, it's gonna mess up everything. But this movie, you're like, oh yeah, okay, so that's where it goes. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, that shouldn't work. The whole ending to this movie, I kind of want to wait on it a little bit and talk about a few other things, but I will just say that the ending of this room made me feel like I was watching like a Monty Python skit and they just didn't know how to end it. But we'll get into that in a little more detail in a little bit. But I mean, you're right. Like it sounds so weird to say that it's fun to watch and that moment is fun, but it is, because again, Charles Durning's performance when he gets up on the table and just seeing, because he's, you know, the way he's built, he's very round, he's very rotund, and he's got this like childlike energy when he starts to do his stretches that was just infectious, and like the look on his face. So I just loved him. And then you juxtapose that with like John Mahoney as the chief in the newsroom, who is another actor. There's so many actors in this I just love seeing. And John Mahoney, he does everything from that chair in that room. It's the only stuff he is in, just yelling at all of his people. But he's great. He's just wonderful the whole time. Everybody was. Bruce Campbell. I had completely forgotten Bruce Campbell was going to be in this. And he doesn't have a ton to do. But man, when he's there, it's great. Always, because it's Bruce Campbell. He's always a win. Mm-hmm. I even the one board member that's giving this kind of the rundown of everything at the beginning of it, talking about record profits, record gross, record all that, Roy Brocksmith. He is I always remember him from Star Trek, The Next Generation. He was in one episode of that, but he was memorable. It's his voice. He's got a voice that you don't forget if you've heard it. Mm-hmm. So many of those. Even, who was it? Bill Cobbs as Moses. You mentioned him working in the clock tower. He's a character that makes no sense whatsoever. He just is in the clock tower. But there's this interesting kind of allusions to something supernatural going on that I don't fully know what it was supposed to be exactly. And I might gain more out of it if I watch the movie again. But is he supposed to be God? Is that, or just an angel?
I think every single Coen Brothers has a side character that represents God and a side character that represents the devil. Like it's just a thing that they love to do. There has to be someone that doesn't talk and just makes angry faces that is surrounded by fire and represents the devil. Like it's in every single one of them. So they had to put it in there.
Yeah. And you had Moses and Aloysius, which was great. Cause like that name just gets mentioned the one time. And that one, I will say that one, it confused me when I saw him, at the end, but we'll get there. But I did I love those characters. Who was it that played Jim True Frost as Buzz? Buzz was great. I loved Buzz. Just working the elevator. And he was, what I liked about Buzz is he's got that elevator operator's uniform on, that kind of, it's almost like a bellboy uniform and the little hat. And we only ever see him in there until he comes into the office to pitch his idea to Barnes, Norval Barnes. But when we see him again later on, he's still wearing that dumb little hat when they run into him on the street. I loved that. It's a little touch. They didn't have to do that, but it makes it so much better to see him still wearing that dumb little hat while he's out with, Zsa Zsa? Was that her name? The Anna Nicole Smith character? I just loved stuff like that. It was so, so good. What was the other? Oh, even some smaller stuff from the party. Some other character actors that popped up. Peter Gallagher is the crooner, the lounge singer. Yeah. He's great. Sort of a Dean Martin style. And then Noble Willingham. I'll never not like Noble Willingham in something. Because you need somebody to be a rich Texan or just a Texas cowboy. You would get Noble Willingham. He's like straight out of Central Casting. He's got the perfect Texas accent. Was amazing.
Yeah, what's amazing about this movie is like every single character in every background like has a moment. There's no one like we talked about that board. Like when you were on the board, like I have, you know, people have favorite board members. The guy that talks about the mezzanine, the guy with the weird eyebrows. Like you know, normally in that scene, the joke is that they're all the same, right? You got the guy at the head, and they're all just sucking up. But everyone has their own little comedic game. And like when they.
Yes.
In the diner, those two cab drivers that narrate what's going on, and they have gas. Like I would watch a whole movie about any one of these characters, and like you got to imagine like these people getting the call, like I got a job in a movie, but it's like it's one scene. I'm in the background, I'm in a diner, and not know that they're gonna have one of the most memorable scenes in history because it's just. Yeah,
I loved those two guys in the diner. Like that scene started, and then I kind of realized what was going on and what they were doing. And I'm like, it just got better and better. And then to have it addressed where the waitress comes up to ask him what they want at the end, like and what's great about that is you've got so like from a shooting perspective and a storytelling perspective, I love a scene like that, right? Because we're introduced. And we get the scene unfolding and those guys are talking and they're narrating it. So they're, but I don't think we see them at the start of the scene, right? We just hear them.
I think we see them for one shot.
Okay. Maybe we do, but like either way, they're narrating things. So they become that omniscient narrator, that voiceover as the scene's unfolding. And then they bring in the waitress and have her step directly into the middle of the shot in between what we've been watching and the guys talking. And suddenly now we're there and now we're not just observing the scene with an omniscient narrator. We're now in their perspective to then flip the shot over where they're just like, bromo. Like I absolutely love stuff like that. It's so, and it's such a Coen Brothers thing to do. It's a type of thing. Roger Deakins loves doing that. And I adored it. Absolutely adored it.
Yeah, and even like the way they wrote the joke, like I don't know what bromo is, especially when I'm 13. I didn't know what bromo was. Right. I still don't know.
Exactly.
But that joke, where you like, you get it. They've set up the comedic bit so, for so much about the gas that you're like, I bet that's gas medicine. I bet, you know, it doesn't matter. Like they're not afraid to use like this old timey. A lot of people would be afraid of like people aren't going to get this joke, but it's like, no, instead of being afraid, let's just make sure we think about how we set up the joke and do it. I don't know. It's just so much care into every single line.
That's it right there. There is so much care into the words and then how it's presented in all of their movies. If you look at something like The Big Lebowski, there's so much care into all those scenes and they're all very much that movie. And there's stuff that shouldn't work but does because they put that care into it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Like The Lady Killers is an example of one where it worked less than other Coen Brothers outings. But they made those choices and they went for it. And here they put all that care into it and they crafted everything to give you a specific feeling and a specific visual style. And it just worked. Even simple stuff like they get Steve Buscemi as the beatnik bartender. The beatnik bar that we're told about early on in the movie. And I'll be honest, I'd completely forgotten about it until he popped up in there. You know, at that point in the movie, I was like, oh, this is the beatnik bar. Oh, that's cool. And he's the beatnik barman, like little, just all sorts of stuff like that. You know, the montage of making the hula hoop, the dingus, which by the way,
is great. Do you know who directed that?
Was that whole sequence was not
Sam Raimi. It was not directed, that he was second unit. And they're like, why don't you shoot this whole sequence? That's one of the most amazing sequences in cinematic history.
You know, I didn't know that it was him. I knew that he helped, I think, co-wrote the story for this, or at least got a story credit. And I did read that he was one of the silhouettes in the, of the like marketing guys coming up with the name. But I didn't realize that he directed that whole sequence, because that montage is one of the best montages I've ever seen. It's so good.
It is.
The whole thing, start to finish, is just amazing. It's hard for me to say it's my favorite moment because there's so many. Then I think about another point in the movie and I'm like, well, but I love that. And that was one of my favorite moments. And I think about, you know, there's just so many of those. And I think that's one of the things I love about the Coen Brothers movies is every time I watch one, I can't pick a specific single moment that I like more than anything else. And it's whether it's Raising Arizona, whether it's Big Lebowski, whether it's No Country for Old Men, like there's so many moments in that movie that just they have a way of evoking emotion out of things. Not always happy emotions. They definitely go for dour downers a lot, but they get emotion and they get me feeling things when I'm watching their movies. And I love that. I also like that they put John Goodman in everything. Because John Goodman should be in everything, even if it's just as a newsreel announcer, because I've definitely noticed his voice. And I'm like, that is John Goodman right there. You don't forget that voice. And he was good. I didn't see Richard Schiff at all. I'm seeing him in the cast list right now. He was in The Newsroom, which was one of the mailroom screamers. That was another moment I absolutely adored, was the whole whole mailroom sequence when he first gets the job and he's walking through there, and the whole they'll dock ya speech, like that was amazing. And they did it all in one take.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. I just, over and over, it got better and better. The more I think about it, the more I like it.
Yeah. The thing with that line, like there's nothing better when the Coen brothers repeat a line like 14 times, because for a purpose every time, and it makes you think about something. Like, and that what I love about this one is not only, you know, they got the mezzanine, they got the dock here, you got, you know, for kids, but they also did it visually. like the way they kept mm-hmm. like when they have the measuring tape around his waist turns into the ticker tape from how the stock's doing. Like yep. you have the circle for the hula hoop that becomes the coffee ring. It becomes the straw. It becomes the frisbee. Like they're just taking these elements and showing to him again and again, but every time it means something different. Yeah. Just I don't know. Every point I make is going to end with just I don't know how to
just so mwah, chef's kiss. It's just like for instance a dumb moment. But it's absolutely perfect, and it needs to be in there. Is when he first comes into Mossberg's office, Sydney's office, or Mossberger, he's got the blue letter that he's supposed to deliver, mm-hmm. Which that whole scene was great, like the blue letter thing and everybody hiding. And I love that it's his first day, right? Everybody sees the blue letter, they freak out, they're it's chaos, everybody's hiding everywhere, and here you've got Norville. And he doesn't know why he wants to hide. He just knows that he needs to. And he keeps like failing at doing it. Like he runs and then he comes back out and he goes back in and back out. And he's just got piles of stuff. So he gets the blue letter. So it's very like Warner Brothers cartoon there for a second. Then he gets the blue letter. And now he's got to do the walk of shame. And he gets in the elevator and Buzz is talking to him. And I loved Buzz giving him all his dumb jokes as they're going up. And talking to everybody. And then when he realizes he's got the blue letter, like express elevator, telling him, you know, good luck, you're going to need it, all that. So he gets into Mossberger's office. And instead of giving him the blue letter, he's going to go for it. He shoots his shot and he pulls the piece of paper out of his shoe and he holds it up and it's the circle. But the best part of that, because it's such a dumb, he's like, I've been working on this for a couple of years, holds that up and then looks at it and flips it around 180 degrees. I lost it at that point. I had to pause for a second because it was just so perfect of a moment for him to do that. It was like that was just the cherry on top of the sundae. The whole scene to that point had already been great. And then that just put it over the top and made it so much better because the dumbness of like, oh, it's upside down. It's a circle.
Yeah. I love when a movie like actually shows why something happened. Like there's so many movies about founders and the idea is like, no one could see their vision. No one thinks to understand, mm-hmm. but like, they're just this genius that like no one takes the time to listen to, but this shows exactly why no one listens to him. He's the worst pitch man in the world. Yes. He doesn't provide any context, or he just thinks everyone else will see what's in his head. It's a circle drawn on a dirty piece of paper, and he's like, they're supposed to imagine the hula hoop. You know, for kids.
And you mentioned the repeating of lines, the repeating of motifs. Absolutely love that kind of stuff. I love callbacks too, whether it's within the scene or it's something that gets called back later on. I love stuff like that. That's clever writing to me. I love the, you know, for kids, or Paul Newman's character is always sure.
Yeah.
I love that repeating thing. Like, it's just, I can't say enough good things about this. I had so much fun watching this movie. And I'm just kind of mad that it took me this long to see, because I would have been one of those telling all sorts of people to see it myself. I would have been like, no, you need to watch the Hudsucker Proxy. Oh, it's fantastic. Because it is. It's so good. And it just, I can see this one being one that will get better the more times I watch it too. Because I'll pick up on certain things.
I've seen it a lot and it still gets better every time.
That's, I love it. Okay, so I got to talk about this ending because it did confuse me at first and I kind of had to wrap my head around it. But because to this point, we haven't really gotten much in the supernatural going on. The closest we got is the idea of like the newspaper that he had been reading, but he didn't see the one posting. Because I wholeheartedly identified with Norville when he's job hunting and everything's like experience required, 5 years experience. And he's sitting there like, I don't have any experience. What am I going to do? That one hit close to home because I've definitely been there. But he's reading that newspaper over and over. and he doesn't see the large ad that says no experience necessary, but that happens to be where he puts his coffee cup. And then when he leaves, that's the closest supernatural thing we get, is like that, you know, the wind blowing the paper and chasing him down the street, effectively. Fate. Yeah.
Extreme fate.
But then when he falls off the building and he's falling, and then all of a sudden time stops, we get a fourth wall break, and Moses, who to this point has done an opening narration and been in one scene where he just knows stuff, but we don't know how he knows anything or who he is or what he is, to have, you know, Norville stop mid fall, and then we see the clock and it's not moving, and he, you know, he's jammed the mop into the gears. And I just love that fourth wall break of like, well, strictly speaking, not supposed to do that. It was a little jarring at first. I'm like, what is happening? What, all of a sudden we're in a very different movie. But the movie is able to steer into that skid and use it perfectly. You know what I mean? Like, they have that moment, and then all of a sudden you get the angel of Hudsucker coming down, which, by the way, might be my favorite depiction of an angel, because it's got that, like, that halo that's rotating above him. That
hula hoop, yeah.
Yeah, the hula hoop halo is rotating above him. It's so good. It's Charles Durning. And he's talking to him, and he's like, well, why didn't you give him the blue letter? And there again, there's that callback. Because I had a note for myself, I'm like, he never gave him the blue letter. That certainly won't become important later.
Mm-hmm. And so, speaking of callbacks, like, you know, one of the jobs when you're writing something like that, you want the audience to forget about it before you call it back. And mm-hmm. if you watch movies with a big twist, like if you watch The Sixth Sense, every time there's a clue, they'll immediately, something weird happens at, like, there's a close up on a kid with weird glasses, or there's like,
yep.
you know, the creepy Pop-Tart scene. Like, they always have something happen that distracts you, so you don't think about it. In yeah. this movie, they never stop making sure you know that that blue letter is there. Like, you get he'll just pick up a phone and someone will be screaming at him about the blue letter. It's like a parody yeah. of that thing. Like, but even still, even though I never stop thinking about the blue letter, when he says, any reason you didn't deliver my blue letter, I'm like, oh, blue letter. I forgot about that.
It's they hide it in plain sight, right? They distract yeah. you with so much going on while also telling you, like, hey, this didn't happen, by the way. Don't forget about this thing, that eventually you just tune that out and you don't think about it. And yeah. so then when it pops back up, you're right. You do the, you know, Leo DiCaprio pointing at the screen. Oh, the blue letter. So then that's happening. Time has stopped. And then you've got Aloysius, that character who we've only seen. He doesn't speak, right? He's just been scraping paint off the one door, writing names on the other glass door, all of that. But he did bring the info to Musburger about mm-hmm. About everything. He also is able to move. So you've got Norville is stuck midair. You got the angel of Hudsucker there talking to him, and everyone else is frozen except for Moses in the clock and Aloysius. And that's when I realized, oh, okay, these are your, I sort of figured out that they're the yin and yang, the God and devil characters. And I love that they have like a fist fight. They have a straight up, you know, fist fight right there in the clock tower. I like that. But on paper, if you haven't seen this movie and you're hearing us talk about this, it doesn't make any sense and it shouldn't work. It should be like, well, what the hell is going on? Why? But in the context of the movie, it works. And I loved it. I honestly enjoyed this ending so much for its silliness, because the movie had sort of earned getting to go to that next level with the type of world that they had created, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like if you imagine like a story of mythology, like you have the character who's in charge of time, he mm-hmm. keeps the clock running, and you have the character who's in charge of power. That's the guy that scrapes the name off and puts the name of the new guy that's in power. Like, that's their job. So it's like, when you watch the movie, it's like, oh, those are two guys that work at, you know, work at this place. But then in that moment, you're like, oh yeah, it's they're mythical beings that control time and power. Okay, cool, got it.
Yep. Yeah. No, that is perfect. Because it's the type of thing, consciously, I'm not thinking about that as I'm watching the movie. But hearing that said, thinking about it after the fact, all makes perfect sense. And that's how allegory works. And that's how you do it well. And that's what the Coen brothers are so good at. They did it again with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And you've got the character, the guy that's always wearing the sunglasses in it. That's the devil character that's going after them. I can't think if they ever give him a name, and I know the actor, but I can't think of his name either. But like that kind of thing, or, you know, whatever you do with all these different characters, they're just so good at doing that and weaving these stories. And it's just impressive.
Yeah. Raising Arizona. You got the guy on the motorcycle that leaves flames behind him. They love that kind of thing.
Yep. Well, and what's great about it is they can do something. They can also do it very subtly, but they can do stuff. And because they create these sort of hyper-realistic worlds and they're unique to their stories, they can have some fun with that and go a little goofy and it work, right? Like Randall Tex Cobb's character in Raising Arizona, again, on paper, shouldn't work, but it does because it fits the tone of that movie. And here, having your good and evil characters or your time and power, or however you want to describe them, shouldn't work. Like it should feel out of place, but it doesn't. Even though the movie's never gone that far into supernatural, it fits in the world that we're dealing with. I just loved, like, I loved so many things about the story being told, but these characters are what did it. And these performances, I mean, just up and down, never get tired of them. Cause you got like Amy Archer, she wants to not, like, you can see the hurt on her when, Norville kind of calls her out as, you know, the, wanting to just be one of the boys, and like everything he says to her in that scene. Obviously, he's not realizing he's telling it to Amy Archer. He thinks he's telling it to his secretary. But you can see the hurt on her face, and that performance was really good because after that, she does try to tell him multiple times. She realizes that, yeah, he's kind of a rube, but he's also not. Like, he's not dumb. He's just being manipulated, but she can never get through to him because he's riding the high of everything that's going on, and he doesn't listen to her. And he even goes so far as to like project who he thinks she is onto her. And she eventually kind of has to take back that agency and be like, no, you're dumb. Here's all the reasons that you're dumb. And I quit. I'm leaving, and just walks out. And I liked that. And again, Jennifer Jason Leigh, she was fantastic in this. So,
mid-Atlantic accent, like that's, she's going right from the movies at time. If you want to see a movie that, if you watch the movie, Meet John Doe from 1941, you'll see where a lot of the elements from this film come from. It's not the same plot, but like they take certain elements and characters and kind of like mold it into this film. It's like, it's one of their biggest influences, I think. And they just take all these influences from that era and, put it right into the film.
Yeah. No, I haven't seen that movie, but I can already kind of feel like I know roughly what it's going to look and sound like just based on other movies of that era. And then if it influenced this, I have some idea. Trying to think of a couple of notes I had. Oh, go ahead.
Let's say for any listeners that don't know, like the accent we're talking about that Amy Archer does is the Mid-Atlantic accent. And that was a completely fictional accent that came about because in the early days of film, the microphones weren't that good and couldn't like pick up normal speech that great. So they made a specific accent that hit the syllables that the mic had difficulty picking up. So that's why if you watch old movies, people talk real weird. They didn't talk like that in real life. But then once it became popular movies, then people started talking like that because they wanted to be like characters in movies. So she's doing very much that. Art, you know, it's the same thing of when you look at a background and can tell it's painted. Like, that's not a mistake. Mm-hmm. they're creating an artificiality, and doing that accent does the same thing and places you in that time.
Yeah. One of my favorite things to find on YouTube are videos of like behind the scenes of old Hollywood, where you'll see actors in a scene and they're doing their mid-Atlantic accents, and then they cut, or there's a blooper or something, and they break and they just talk normal. Because for so long, all we had was the movies and the TV shows. So you kind of thought that's what people talked like back then, and they didn't. It's just that's how it got recorded. So I love stuff like that. That's so great. And it is a very distinct accent, too. Like when you hear it, you know it. It's that old newsreel voice, that kind of thing. So you definitely have heard it before. But yeah, I loved the fact. And I really like the fact that, like, Amy Archer is the only character that really talks like that throughout the movie. Like, nobody else really uses it, certainly not to the extreme that Amy Archer does as a character. And so it makes her stand out amongst, you know, the Paul Newmans and the Tim Robbins and all of that that's going on. So I did enjoy that, because it kind of gives a feel like her as a character thinks that's how she should sound, because there are moments where she breaks from that too, when she's getting more emotional. So it's just a great layer to the character and the character work that she did. I love all that kind of stuff. I had some notes here, like, cause okay. Moses to me as a character reminded me, granted, because I saw Big Lebowski first, he reminds me a bit of the cowboy from a Big Lebowski. Right. That's sort of that same omniscient character, that just seems to know, everything that's going out. What was it? I did have stuff like the new in, old out, like Tim Robbins is brand new coming into the building at the same moment that, Hudsucker is jumping out. I love that. And showing that we mentioned a little bit earlier, she literally passed out. I don't know what that note was about, but, and Buzz talking in rhyme. That was the other one I liked. Mm-hmm. Was his, he had a name for everybody and he was in rhymes and all that kind of stuff. Was really good. Again, the four kids, which I've said a lot and I've heard a lot, and I never really realized that this is where it came from, was the, you know, for kids. Now I get the reference even more, and it makes it funnier retroactively, but I didn't really realize that at the time. Also the use of the word dingus when they coined the hula hoop as a dingus, just made me laugh. I love that. Extruded plastic dingus was on the blueprint.
One of the things that fascinates me is I've been trying to figure out, I can't figure out when Arthur Mellon died. Arthur Mellon is the guy who actually invented the hula hoop. Like, what would you think watching this movie? And like, it's weird to like, let's make a movie about the invention of the hula hoop, but we don't care how it was invented, who invented, we're just going to make up our own thing. It kind of reminds me of like this movie that Jerry Seinfeld's doing now about the invention of the Pop-Tart, where it's a completely fictionalized version. I want it to have some real Hudsucker vibes. Like, I love the idea of just like, let's make a movie about this fictional event, but we don't care at all how it actually happened.
Right. Yeah, because it in the end, that doesn't really matter, but it's also great to make it not matter and just go with it. And I like that for the first hour of the movie, the only time it's ever brought up is just the picture of the circle and him saying, you know, for kids. It's not until that hour in that we figure out, oh, it's a hula hoop. The circle is a hula. Okay. And then when Buzz later comes in with his same circle and it's just a circle, but then you get the reveal that it's the bendy straw. And now Norville's got the bendy straw he's like holding on to for parts of the rest of the movie. I just like, it's so dumb. And then the last time around, it's the same design, but now it's a Frisbee at the end of the movie. Cause he's got a new idea. He's the idea man. And so that was great. That's again, that kind of that running gag, those callbacks, This works so well. And I just love, you know, for kids. Like, of course you're going to know what that means.
Yeah.
To every, because that's all he ever said to anybody. Like the old man in the mailroom that's just throwing mail into all the slots, has been there for, what was it, 48 years or something?
Yeah, the timelessness of the movie. You know, it's made in the 90s, takes place in the 50s. Like, it jokes are so timeless. Like, you know, I hadn't watched it. Like I said, I've watched it thousands of times, but I haven't watched it in a few years. And just watching it now, like the scene where John Mahoney is like pitching headlines about Norval Barnes, about the innovator and the idea man. Like, it, I felt like it was a political cartoon making fun of Elon Musk coverage. Like, it feels like it's written today. Like,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. It's so good. I did see, and I don't know how much validity there is to this, that Clint Eastwood was offered the role of Sidney Musburger. That feels so odd to me. Because it just, like, it would have been done so differently from Paul Newman, yeah, right? Yeah. And I think Eastwood could be funny, but it's hard for me to picture it. After seeing the movie, it's hard for me to picture Clint Eastwood in that particular role with the rest of the movie going on. Like, I get that sort of, the thing that pops to mind when I picture Clint Eastwood on the set of a Hudsucker Proxy, it could work, but all I can think of is Tommy Lee Jones talking to Jim Carrey, making Batman Forever, saying, "I cannot sanction your buffoonery." Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that would be Clint Eastwood the whole time on that movie, of like, what is going on here? Like, just grinding his teeth,
yeah,
trying to figure out what is happening.
And the Coen brothers, especially Coen brothers in this vein, it's a lot about controlling of facial expressions and like, mm-hmm, freezing on Sidney J. Musburger when he's falling, and like the weird expression on his face. Clint Eastwood, not famous for having a lot of different facial expressions.
It's true. It's very true. Yeah, no, this movie is a ton of fun. I did capture some audio from it. There was a lot. Because what I'll do is I will, to give a little peek behind the curtain for folks when I'm prepping for a podcast episode, is I'll watch the movie and just watch it. But as I'm watching it, I'm taking notes to myself of like, just little one-liners, little things that get me, like a button and a satchel is one of my notes, just because I thought that was funny. And then, you know, you cut to Bruce Campbell's character's drawing. So I had stuff like that, but I'm also writing down rough timestamps of like moments or sounds or lines that I think are interesting to then go back and capture later. And then I'll do a second pass watching the movie where I'm paying more attention to those moments, and also kind of trying to be a little more, try to analyze the movie a little bit more. So I want, if it's a movie that I'm watching for the first time, I want that first watch through to just be me sitting back enjoying the movie. So I get the fresh, like, I just went to the theater or I just rented a movie experience. And then I can dive into my analyzing mode. I wrote down so many moments, timestamps to clip audio. It was ridiculous. I had like 30 something audio clips that I wanted to get at one point. I didn't capture all of them, but I got a lot of them, because there was just so much that was so funny and so interesting in this. So I got to play a few of these. But you had something you want to say first.
I was going to say the trick to that, the reason there's so many things that are memorable, is that this movie will take all the things that in any other movie would just be exposition, or like, we have to get through the scene and introduce it, but they'll be like, let's give it a comedic bit. Let's give an A, like that we talked about the bromo scene. But another one is in the newsroom where she's talking about her plan, and the guy that does a crossword is in the background calling out things. And then it becomes part of the rhythm of how she talks, and she will use word. And that doesn't make sense because he's writing the crossword. Why would he ask the answer to a crossword if he's writing it? But you don't think about that in the moment. It just gives them a reason to talk in a certain way and make it funny. If they didn't do that, it would just be her sitting at a desk. You know, many other directors would just be like sitting at a desk saying, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go here. I'm going to do this. I'm going to trick him this way. He said this to me, but give it a comedic bit. And all of a sudden it's a hilarious scene that would have been like filler.
And it's utilizing the whole of your scene. It's her. Mm-hmm. She's the focal point of the scene. and then you got Smitty there, but this guy that's just a background, it's sort of, you mentioned it earlier, like background characters that are important to scenes that wouldn't on paper have any reason to be there. He's just dude working on thing back there, working on the crossword, which, by the way, I love that he's got a huge easel with the crossword on it. It's like 6 foot by 6 foot, and he's sitting up on a on like a ladder to work on this thing for a newspaper. That cracked me up too. Like visually, it's very funny. And then to work all the dialogue into it, it's just genius. And to have her, like, she does it once, and then it's like 2 or 3 more times where she gives a line of dialogue saying something to the effect of, like, you know, 8-letter word for this or 4-letter word for this. And he's not even listening to her anymore, which was even better.
Yeah. And the fact that like she gets some of them wrong, like brings you, like, as soon as you, okay, I get what he's doing. And then she says gnu instead of emu. And you're like, oh no, wait, she got like, as soon as you start like zoning out of what they're talking about, it brings you back in. Cause you're, oh, I'm smarter than the character for 1 second. And then she corrects herself, and they really think about how to get you to pay attention. They're throwing so much information at you, and they really think about how to get you to pay attention to it.
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, okay, so this is a pretty simple sound clip, but it was too good not to capture.
Can I get you boys anything else?
Bromo.
I shortened it down a little bit. There's a longer pause in there, but Bromo. They need the Bromo. You got, this one's just called Blue Letter. Pretty sure this is about the Blue Letter, but I guess we'll listen and find out. Or I didn't capture it well and there's no audio, so we'll skip that one. Buzz getting introduced. I love introductions like this. And this is when he's got the Blue Letter and he's got to get into the elevator. So he walks up and you get Buzz.
Hiya, buddy. My name's Buzz. I got the fuzz. I make the elevator do what she does.
Everything's in rhyme and he's amazing. I want, like you said this earlier, where you want to watch an entire movie based on some of these side characters. I want a whole movie on the life of Buzz. Buzz would be amazing to have, like, even a short film about a lot of these side characters, the two cabbies in the diner, Buzz, Moses and Aloysius, like all of these silly characters from all over the place. I'd love the beatnik bartender. What kind of crap has he had to deal with on New Year's Eve? I also love that the whole movie takes place in a month, but so much happens. Because they had 30 days. Yeah. And yet, you know, so much happens in that 30 days. This one is self-explanatory. Some of these didn't capture right.
The dingus is quite simple, really.
That was a good one. This was, okay. This sound clip is the chief, John Mahoney, but it's a reused line from Raising Arizona that was, I believe, spoken by Noble Willingham in Raising Arizona.
Yeah, and if a frog had wings, it wouldn't bump its ass a hopping.
If a frog had wings, it wouldn't bump its ass a hopping. Because that, right? I'm not wrong there. That sounds like something Noble Willingham would have said. Like, I can hear it in his voice. So, okay. First off, starts the movie off. We got the opening narration going on, which always is fun. But I had to capture this because I'd never heard this term before, which is...
Is Norville really going to jelly up the sidewalk?
Jelly up the sidewalk. I assume...
Yeah, it's not necessarily a phrase people use, but it gives you an image.
It does. It very much does. The board member talking about all the money that they've made. And I love, and there again, there's a scene. There's so many of these that are either one take, or in this case, it's this character taking a big breath and then just talking forever. And so much so that the scene actually fades out and comes back and he's still talking. And it's like, does he breathe through his ears? What did he do here? But for him to go through all that talking about, you know, we've got this and we're records, this record, this record, this. And basically
we're loaded.
We're loaded. was so good. And then that is the moment where Hudsucker is like, and this is where I check out, and gets up and does his little shimmy. So that was pretty good. Okay. The psychiatrist that sort of shows up, you know, partway through the movie, and they have the whole film reel they're showing in front of the board. I love that moment. That also felt very Brazil, but very Coen Brothers. And I just loved him talking about doing the ink blot test, because it was the way he, what Norville answered to all the ink blots were a clip that captured too much crap. So I get these like long bits of silence for some reason. This is what I get for not listening to them beforehand.
Nothing much. I don't know. Just a blotch, but sure beats me.
Honestly, when I do a Rorschach test, that's usually what I see.
And the comedic rhythm of that scene where at first you're like, yeah, okay, it's not recognizable. And the last one is clearly two rabbits.
Yeah. Yep. So we did have, oh, I loved this one from Moses, the fourth wall break from him, which again, shouldn't work, right? Like that should take you out of that moment. But instead, I just thought it was hilarious.
Strictly speaking, I'm never supposed to do this, but have you got a better idea?
No, I don't have a better idea. I don't know how to end this sketch either. So that was pretty good. We had, just like the psychiatrist and his like rapid fire of, you know, I don't know, whatever, the cadence and the speed with which jokes will get fired in these movies is great. Early on when Norville first goes to Musburger's office, and I love Musburger's like, ooh, you can see the gears turning in his head, like, oh, this could be my guy. And so he's like, so you're not an educated man. Well, no, I went to college. Well, but you didn't do well in your studies. No, I made the dean's list. Ah, but your friends thought you were a jerk. Like he's trying to pigeonhole this guy into being what he wants him to be. And I loved
Dipstick. Oh, lame brain. Oh. Schmo.
Dipstick. Schmo. Schmo is a great one, by the way. Schmo is an insult that I don't think we hear enough. Start calling people schmoes. Because it's not terrible. You're just a schmo. We did have the repeated stuff, you know,
for kids.
Now I have that and I can play it whenever I want.
You know, for kids.
Because, you know, for kids. Just like sure. That's always a good one. Or the mezzanine one early on in that first boardroom scene. That got me. That really got me. Because it's called back in such a great way. It's, what was it? He fell 44 floors, 45, including the mezzanine, counting the mezzanine. And then to call back to that, but in reverse.
And then later use it in a context that makes no sense.
Yes.
He just really likes talking about, that guy just loves mezzanines. Okay. He likes to talk about them, fit it into a conversation.
That is his thing. Or, I also loved this one.
How soon before HUD's paper hits the market?
January 1st.
30 days.
4 weeks.
A month at the most.
Four different guys have to tell them the same thing. They all got to justify being on that board.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, it just shows everyone wants to speak up. They all want to say something, even if it's already been said. Because it's a simple joke, but it says so much about the characters. They all like, I want to say something.
Yep. Oh, it was very, very good. I also love, again, callbacks. Callbacks are very good. When, I don't remember if they give him a name, the board member with the big eyebrows that's always crying, when he decides he's going to pull a Hudsucker and he gets up on the table and they're all watching me like, no, don't, what are you doing? And all that. And he gets up the courage and he runs down to the table and jumps and hits the window and just splats on it like a cartoon character. Mm-hmm. And you get a sound clip that's not going to play right. Here it comes.
Plexiglass.
Had it installed last week.
And he's just stuck there. Yep. The squeaking as he slides down. Because I both knew something like that was going to happen, but I wasn't 100% sure. I'm like, how is this gag going to end? And the plexiglass was perfect. So yeah, that was great. So Norville he's educated. He's a college grad, but he gets things wrong.
College of Business Administration.
Muncie, Indiana. But he gets stuff wrong. And I love that because it makes it feel like a real character, right? Because so often in a movie or a TV show, if somebody is supposed to be intelligent, they just know everything about everything. You never see them ever flub or make mistakes. And so here he is. He's talking to Amy Archer, and they've just had this very touching moment where he's given the whole description of maybe we met each other in a past life as deer or antelope or whatever. But then when he comes out of that moment and he says,
"Seriously, Amy, it's what your beatnik friends call karma."
Karma.
Karma. Like that makes him more likable and more relatable because he's on the right track. He just doesn't quite get it right. And I love that.
Yeah, and again, having one of those lines say so much about the character, that just says to you, he learned from books. He didn't learn from life. That's why he's so naive. Like it's just the inflection of one syllable tells you so much about this character.
Mm-hmm. Also, Tim Robbins can just make weird noises. When I covered and did Howard the Duck a while back, I don't remember how many episodes ago it was, and he makes some weird like Daffy Duck type noises at one point in that movie. So here, when he finds out she's from Muncie and he comes out of the bathroom, which that whole scene, like it cracked me up that he carried her out of that diner and literally carried her all the way back up the elevator into his office. But when he gets up, when he takes one drink of the alcohol and rushes for the bathroom, when he finds out she's from Muncie and he busts back in, and I just loved, he got so excited and then he starts making the weirdest noises and I had to get that. Like he had to have like ad-libbed that, right? That wasn't, it wasn't in the script. I really hope he did, but it was so good. It was so good.
Yeah. I'm zooming in from South Korea, but I did visit America recently, went on a road trip, and I went a couple hours out of my way just to drop by Muncie, Indiana. Just like a walk down the street screaming, "Fight on, dear old Muncie."
Yes. Oh, I loved that. I liked him in the scene with Barnes and Amy Archer, where he is tearing down Amy Archer, the Pulitzer winning journalist, to her, not knowing it's her. But then when he walks up at the end and he says,
"Say, Amy, how about you and I grab a little dinner and a show after work? I was thinking maybe the King and I." How about Oklahoma?
He has no idea why he's getting slapped, and I love that he just goes with it. And like, how about Oklahoma? That was so good. And my last one is a very kind of Abbott and Costello type exchange, and this is at the end. This is where you've got Norville's reading the blue letter, finally. And Hudsucker is floating there talking to him. And again, this is Charles Durning. Like he's so good at being this, like, just, I am done with you type. Right. In O Brother, Where Art Thou? He was doing that with his sons. And in here where Norville's trying to read the blue letter, and it's just, you can hear it in his voice.
"And even fall
mail
without fear of the whims of the stockholders or an impatient board. The new president must be free to fall,
fail,
and learn to fail,
fall,
and rise again."
Fail, fall. Like, he's just like, what the hell? How is this guy doing anything? He can't even read my letter. I'd love it. I love that so much. This movie is a ton of fun. You picked a great one to talk about. Thank you so much for bringing this one to my attention and getting me to watch it. Cause I needed to.
I was excited to watch it because, like, we're not going to get a movie like this again. Like, the fact that they gave them so much money for this script, like, you know, people can make movies with this great a script, but the amount of money it took to pull this off and how badly it bombed, like, it's, you know, same thing we're talking about, come here, Shawshank. Shawshank bombed, but then it, like, struck back. This one never did. And it's just, like, it's just such a perfect film that is so much not for everyone. Like, I'll admit, I know people that I wouldn't recommend this movie to because they'd be like, what did you make me watch? But it's a niche film that has been given the resources to make exactly what it wants to be perfectly. We will never get a film like that again. So I hope everyone can watch it and appreciate it for what it is.
You, I think, described the Coen brothers films better than I have ever heard. A perfect film that's not for everyone. That's exactly what they make. Because it is. I mean, I know plenty of people that I wouldn't recommend seeing Fargo, but Fargo is a nearly perfect film. There's nothing wrong with it. This is one of those. I mean, this was a $40 million budget in this film in 1994, which doesn't sound like a lot by today's standards. It was a lot back then. For a comedy, especially, and for a very stylized comedy at that, and to do, and it, I mean, bombed isn't even the right word for it. Its worldwide gross was less than $3 million at the theater, you know, box office. Like, just nuts.
Well, I mentioned them reusing the sets for Batman. 1999's Batman, the budget was $30 million. So they gave this movie more money than Batman. And like I said, they spent so much money. I listed some of them, but they had to reuse the sets for The Shadow, Batman Forever, Independence Day, Batman and Robin, Godzilla, Bewitched, and Baby's Day Out. Like, they spent so much money, so much more money than like the big blockbuster superhero movie that they had to like strip it for parts and use it for like a decade after.
Which is crazy to think about. But man, the thing with the movie is you see the money. You see that in this movie all over it. It looks fantastic. I mean, obviously it helps if you have Dennis Gassner doing your production design and Roger Deakins shooting it. Like, there's few that are better than that. I was looking at Dennis Gassner's IMDb, and he does a couple of things. He does production design for Field of Dreams, which he did. And then he gets involved with the Coens on Miller's Crossing. And it's like Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, Hudsucker, Waterworld. That's a movie that has a distinct look to it, whether you like that movie or not. And it did bomb, but it looks good. And the world that they built there, the Truman Show he did, Road to Perdition, Big Fish. Like, this guy's good. Some of the James Bond stuff with Daniel Craig, Quantum of Solace and Skyfall, production design for the Golden Compass. He was also production designer for Blade Runner 2049. So that right there would be enough. Like, that's one movie that would be enough to have you think this guy is amazing. And it's just all these names. And I was looking that over and I was just blown away by it. So him, Deakin shooting it, the Coens writing it, Sam Raimi involved, the cast all over the place. This is just an amazing movie. So thank you so much for getting me to watch it. This was a lot of fun. So Ryan, let people know what you work on. What have you got going on? What do you want people to check out?
Well, I'm Ryan Estrada. I'm an author, artist, and adventurer. That means I travel around the world making comics. You can find my work at ryanestrada.com. Some of the books I've done are Banned Book Club, which is a Eisner nominated Freeman Award winning book about my wife being hunted down by the police reading banned books in the 80s. I have a series called Student Ambassador that is like a kid going around solving mysteries. I got a new one coming out this fall called No Rules Tonight that's about people in Korea in the 1980s who were banned. You know, in Korea, there was a curfew where if you were out after midnight, you go to jail. But the one exception was Christmas Eve. So people would Christmas Eve was the night to get out, go out and party and do whatever you wanted. So I got a lot of stuff. You can check it out at ryanestrada.com. Lots of free comics there. And if you read through my stuff, you'll notice a lot of influences from this movie, because this is basically where all my influences came from.
Hey, it's got to come from somewhere. And after seeing this movie now, this is a good spot. This is a good place to pull influences from. So that's awesome. ryanestrada.com. Check that out. Excellent. So if you enjoy this show and you want to see it recorded live, I do that Sunday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern time at twitch.tv/TVStravis or youtube.com/@TVStravis. You can check it out live there. Comes out as a podcast everywhere you get your podcasts on Wednesdays. Video form on YouTube, audio form, and any of your favorite podcatchers. Check that out. And you can go to TVStravis.com to find links to like merchandise. I've got a Patreon for this show if you want to back it that way. If you just want to listen to it, spread it by word of mouth. I love that too. I do this for fun. So check that out, TVStravis.com. Next episode won't be coming out in a week. It'll be coming out a little bit later than that because I'm going to be in Las Vegas and I'm going to be doing the show live in Las Vegas in front of an audience. So I've got a couple of people who's never seen Labyrinth before. So my friends Joe Hood and Shane Maddox are going to come on. I'm going to make them watch Labyrinth, and then I'm going to proceed to geek out about Jim Henson for an hour with them in Las Vegas. So you'll definitely want to check that one out. It's going to be a lot of fun. Ryan, this was great. Thank you so much for being on. We'll do this again for sure.
All right.
I'm going to find something you haven't seen.
Okay, great. Sounds good.
Excellent.
Anytime.
Yeah. So stay tuned for next episode and Labyrinth, and remember to enjoy your movies and let's be excellent to each other. This has been Wait, You Haven't Seen.
Titty toenails.